And now on Sunday night, one of the great scholars of religion, a Georgetown University professor in religion and international affairs specialising in Islamic studies. He's an expert on radicalisation and Islamophobia, consultant, author, and a man of many parts. For those who may have missed part one of our interview with John Esposito last week, here's a quick glimpse with the man himself explaining something of his background.
You know, having been raised Roman Catholic and Italian Catholic in an area that was overwhelmingly not only Catholic but Italian Catholic, which is why I don't have to think very much about what heaven will be like, except we'll have to admit some of those other people. But the reality of it is that, and then I formally joined the Franciscans for quite a few years. So that, I mean, that's part of my background in terms of, in a general way, appreciating both the good that religion brings as well as the issues. But I think the other thing is that I just found that when I tried other professions, you know, teaching Latin and English, the corporate world, I came back to religion and academically, you know, professionally. And so I became a young Vatican II theologian. But then, by complete accident, I discovered world religions. And that just made me fascinated with world religions and the cultures that they come out of. And so there's a kind of personal and intellectual engagement. But it also does, I think, often say something to me. At the end of the day, I've managed to, I think, see religion in its multiple forms. You know, I see the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I find all three fascinating, at times off-putting. But my career managed to be one in which I was at a point where the world in America was Judeo-Christian. I mean, that's, you know, the lens in America. And then we exploded in terms of other religions. And A, there I was. I was trained for obsolescence, but suddenly I was relevant. Then you had the global resurgence of religion, which not only had people reappropriating their tradition or becoming more deeply involved, many of them, but it also took on a political dimension. And while initially it looked like, oh, that was just happening in Islam, it then became global. And I find that fascinating.
John Esposito from last week's program, speaking of his personal journey. He was in Australia late last year, and some of you may have heard us with the opportunity to talk with him for Sunday night. Well, tonight we conclude the broadcast of our longer two-part interview, and by way of introduction, here's a little Beethoven from the Fifth. From Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. John Esposito, Beethoven wrote much of his music out of an experience of Europe which is tinged with universal optimism, but coming out of a knowledge of difficult times, of dark experience. A lot of people say we're in one of those moments again, where we're at a sort of a bridging point in civilization. Does that notion play with your experience?
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. I mean, I think that, for example, while one can talk about the positive reasons why people, for example, turn to faith or leave faith, and one can even talk about and understand why what I would call mainstream fundamentalists find that approach very accommodating because they can be very modern and technological, but it gives them a certitude, you know, whether they're Christian or Muslim. There's also a dark side. I mean, in my talks, I always say, religion has a transcendent side and it has a dark side. The transcendent side is you believe in a transcendent reality. Also, it helps you, as it were, make yourself a better person. But there's also the dark side, which often we're in denial of. I also think that, therefore, when you look, for example, at the level of violence that occurs in the world, I mean, people forget, you look at the 20th century, you know, Brzezinski's written on this. It was the most warlike and bloodiest century in history. Only we fought it in the name of nationalisms, you know, World War I, World War II, but you had Korea, you had Vietnam. Now we look at the last 20 years and it's ethnic and religious rivalry and violence. We also, I think, see, which is very, it's funny, I'll put it in a way that's provocative. There is a way in which you can argue that we have an incredibly promiscuous situation in terms of culture and society. You know, alongside a lack of belief is not simply, if you will, a sexual revolution that yielded, as it did, tremendous headway. But I think, you know, the moral side of society in terms of the exploitation of sexuality, the problems that we have with, if you will, sex slavery, with pornography, but also the enormous problems we have with environment, global warming, and the denial of all of these things make one wonder. And I think finally, I see the world as extraordinarily violent, not only internationally, but within countries. In America, we often bypass this. It comes up, but then we walk away from it. That is, you know, you look at the number of people that are in American prisons. You look at the number of wars and the level of violence that we have both outside and also inside our country. You know, if you're in Australia and you're probably following what's going on in the U.S., you will see how many in the last couple of years, how many shootings we have, you know, in schools, in churches, etc. And what's interesting is while people like to focus on, well, there's a religious side to it or it's like a, you know, a domestic Muslim threat. The fact is the FBI came out with a report this year. The number one threat are white, anti-government, and a fair number of them are also people who are part of what some of us would call Christian identity movements. I think with all of that, you know, this is not the, you know, from my point of view, the world in which I was raised.
Some people would link that to what they call a sort of demise of high culture or a disrespect for high culture that's in part driven by the media, that it's driven by the media needing to market for the mass market, for the base market. So those respect for the sort of integrity of knowledge, those sorts of arguments, is why science is in trouble, for instance. Everybody's opinion is as valid as anybody
else. And why humanities is under siege, certainly in the United States, but I think it's true in many parts of the world now. And in no way do you see it more clearly in what's going on with universities. That is that the questions being raised about the future of humanities and that in many universities, and you do see incredible sort of cuts being made that are basically based on the bottom line. And some of the cuts wind up going to the very studies and departments of classical languages, literature, music, history. I mean, all of those areas are undergoing tremendous cuts. I was talking to somebody from your country, from Australia, at a university, very established academic, very well known, and we were talking about the fact that, you know, you depending on who you get as a new administrator, and then they go for some of the modern areas, the jazzy areas that are going to pull people in, like security studies, etc., you can then all of a sudden have arguments, and we've seen it in the States, where they begin to wipe out departments of religion, departments of history, English, etc. And so where are we? And the emphasis on what kind of degree you should get then reinforces that if we're not careful, we will turn out a generation that for whom, if you will, the broader understanding of knowledge and the humanities and ethics is deteriorating or is invisible in their lives.
Just let me touch on one thing with regard to universities. You yourself have come under criticism in some circles. They say, oh, John Esposito, he's fine, but the trouble is he's taking money from the Saudis. He's taking money from Wahhabi Islam, and that's leading him to a biased position, one that has no intellectual credibility whatsoever. And that's the subtext you've had to live with yourself for a while.
It's been raised. The reality of it is that, for example, I won't get into areas in which universities may choose to fundraise in terms of my being, you know, critical of them. But in terms of I established our center 23 years ago. Our original donors were a Christian, Arab Christian and Muslim businessmen. Had nothing to do with government. We have never taken money from a government. And in fact, I have been assiduous in general in avoiding any kind of close relationship or inviting very, very rarely will I want to have a senior government official from many governments be there because it gets too politicized, and especially given some of the governments. The funding that we received was from Prince Al-Waleed, and a lot of people don't even look at the context in which that occurred. After 9/11, Al-Waleed, who studied in the U.S., did his B.A. and M.A. there, decided that one of the ways to get beyond where we were was that Arabs had to know more about the West, Western culture and history. And the West needed to know more about Islam, Muslim history, etc. So the first thing he did is fund centers at the American University of Beirut and the American University of Cairo in American studies. Now, we don't have a problem with that normally. You know, we think, in fact, in some cases, in a neo-imperialist notion in the past, we'd be saying, yeah, they should be studying us. So he did that. Then he decided that he wanted to do some funding in the States, and he funded two major universities, Georgetown and Harvard. We had already had our center created, and so the funding that we received, though, enabled us, and it was basically a one-shot funding over a five-year period. In the end, we received a $20 million endowment, which assures that both the center and the positions will be there forever. And he did it for Harvard, and then he did it for two major universities in the UK, okay, with no significant influence. You know, we did what we did. So we do not take money from, we never took money from the Saudi government. And there were opportunities to take money from a number of governments in the region. So I don't see that. What I do see is the real criticism of me in terms of quantitatively will be from people who have a problem with Islam and who have, and with the Muslim world. So as I always say to people, whether I'm doing media interviews, if I'm asked, or when it's a lawyer who really likes me but happens to be a Republican and, you know, voted for George W. Bush or Reagan, I say, well, when you Google me and you will see, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I have probably several million hits, and most of them are very positive about my work and stuff. But you have people who criticize. But the criticism will often be from people who have a problem with Islam and Muslims and wind up saying, gee, you know, you're an apologist for Islam. Now, what's interesting here is that for the first 20 years of my career, that kind of thing was never said, and because we didn't have that polarized situation that we have. And also because people would just say, I don't like what you say, and you're wrong for these reasons. Now it becomes the kind of name-calling, you know. It's the kind of name-calling that we do when we talk about immigrants that we don't like, et cetera. It's name-calling that has charges. And so people do get upset about the fact that I'm a very visible voice. I'm a scholar. I'm a scholar who publishes with major presses. And that adds a certain kind of credibility, you know. So if you don't like what I say, but my publications are, I've done, I launched the first, and I've been on top of many of Oxford University Press's major reference works, and done a lot of publishing on all kinds of aspects. The question then is, do you find issues of scholarship there, or is it that you don't like the conclusions of my scholarship?
Let's pick up on your scholarly observations about the realities of the situation now. We've been at a conference where members of the Muslim community, members of the wider academic community and others have been essentially focused on what do we do now about breaking down those walls, about people returning to a civil discourse about how we build a better society together. Give us the sort of top three points that you'd outline in that quest.
Well, you know, I think one of the things is that it's very important. It's fine to do things from the top down, but I would say that if you want to improve things in societies, I more and more say this in recent years, I say this to Muslim audiences and to non-Muslim audiences and mixed audiences, it's engagement, it's community engagement. In other words, don't just start with the politics that you see out there, unless you're going to spend some time trying to understand, you know, why is there violence in this country? I mean, I often say to people, you have, you know, 50, 55 Muslim countries, okay? Suppose we had, 15 Israel and Palestine's, 15 Northern Ireland situations, in terms of, what would you see? But go from the bottom up. And if people engage in communities, they suddenly wind up, the citizens, they wind up engaging in terms of the schools and the concerns about kids' education or concerns about drugs. They wind up, when disasters come, working together. They meet each other in the professions. We still have in America sometimes statistics that will be as high as 6 out of 10 Americans, 7 out of 10 saying, which is incredible that this could be the case, that they've never really met a Muslim or known a Muslim. If that kind of engagement comes from below, and not seeing it through, as it were, the headline events, as I put, people suddenly would be in a situation where, someone says to me that so-and-so, who's a Sikh or a Hindu or Muslims, are like X, and then I wind up saying, gee, that's funny, because my coworker or my good friend or my neighbor I know is devout in that tradition, and they're not like that at all. Okay, now then you can go take a look at it. So, you're seeing. And one of the reasons why I think major polls are important, there can be problems with polls, is that in the last 10 or 15 years, I say this to people all the time, we now have hard data from Gallup, Pew, and other places. So unlike the past, but we perpetuate it today, you shouldn't just be relying on talking heads in the media, whether it's media people or academics who are in the media, because people can have the same high level of education and be totally disagreeing and talking about massive political situations and populations. Why not actually look and not just listen? You could start by reading my books, please do. I need the royalties to sustain my style of life. But the reality of it is, you're also going to say, but how come I read so-and-so and it's just the opposite? Go look at the hard data. It's not just that I say this is what, based on my research, my experience, how I see Islam or how Muslims think about this or that. I think that makes a big difference. When you go to the hard data, for example, on violence, etc., you find out that the extremists tend to lead with political grievances. Then they will use, if it's religion, they'll use religion. But often they may not. But it's those political grievances. Without the hard data, you're putting on a commercial and you're seeing an extremist, whether it's a Christian justifying why he blew up an abortion clinic and quoting scripture, or it's a Muslim extremist. I think that's really a critical thing in our society. The other thing that I see, which is very strange, is that as I travel and through Europe, and I come here to Australia, and I look at America and other places, the situation's very different in the countries, but I actually see a lot of the political leaders acting like they're totally under siege. And in some countries, they don't have a problem. And they're being super proactive, and you're kind of looking at, if I really look, I see that you've got a population that seems to be pretty well integrated. And yeah, there might be a possibility that you might have some problems with extremism, but the number of cases you're probably going to have in terms of people that are violent or use guns are probably comparable or far less than the actual number of people that you have who are not religious and who are just, extremist. And I think that we need to get beyond that.
Fear is a very powerful political weapon, isn't it?
Fear is what politicians play with all the time. We know that in the U.S. post 9/11, whether people running for Congress or it's people like George W. Bush, but also even with the Obama administration, at times emphasizing, it seems to me, the quote, the threat factor, that works in terms of getting people to vote. And the one thing you can see in the U.S. is that it's election time. In election time, and there were many stories on this, George W. Bush's advisors would basically say, you've got to trump fear and play that and the way you've worked against it. There's also an interesting neuroscience study show that when you emphasize fear and you convince people and they internalize it, they become much more accepting of authoritarianism. They become much more accepting of as it were, that singular message that comes down and that threat that people are talking about. My wife and I travel a lot and live in a lot of places, have in the U.S. It is amazing to me how many people, including people that are our friends, and are otherwise very intelligent, when it comes to talk about immigration issues, and here I'm talking about Mexico and Hispanics before we even get to today, you know, Syrian refugees, how many of our friends who are super educated, when they get into those areas, they key to the fearmongers on Fox and other similar situations and to the politicians and their statements in a super uncritical way. And when those people that they're listening to actually say stuff that is simply wrong, they don't hear it. And I actually, you can go in the States today and see a major TV station in which a senator is saying that X exists in a bill, and the interviewer says, I just did a study on that, and it's not in it. The senator continues to say it, and then you'll get intelligent people who like the senator who say, boy, that interviewer was wrong. They don't bother to double-check the senator. And I think a lot of our fear drives, therefore, the kind of resurgence of racism in America. I mean, it got better, but it was always there, and the level of denial, and certainly the kind of anti-immigrant attitude so that, you know, for example, if you take America, for Syrian refugees to come to America, we have one of the most rigorous processes. It can take up to 2 years. So the good news may be that you wanted to go to America and you're coming. The bad news may be that for 2 years you won't have the documents to get a job. So I think it's, you know, we're operating off that fear factor. And the final point I want to make, if you want to know about the dummy down in our society, look at TV. A lot of the so-called reality shows. I mean, some of them are absolutely pathetic. And look at also the
well, because they operate on the basis of stereotypes.
Absolutely. Stereotypes and that which attracts people. So if you can get people who are loud, crass, who screw each other and denounce each other for doing it, we're in a culture where people just love to watch other people fighting, screaming, and making accusations every week. I mean, it's got... Now, I want to say that I am not... This is the funny thing about it. I am somebody who relaxes by watching TV, and I have probably seen every episode of Law & Order and all the different Law & Order shows two or three times. But that's a lot different, probably because I watch it, but that's a lot different than some of the shows that we have that are just simply false, and particularly also shows that deal with the question of violence and terrorism. They can make for interesting shows, but, you know, when you're watching a movie or a TV show and it deals with violence and terrorism, but it's not specific, but when you're watching shows that are dealing with a specific people or a specific religion and they're totally inaccurate, the danger is you enjoy the intrigue, you enjoy the violence, and we all like to see the bad guys get killed. But the problem is you walk away, and in my generation, it was people walked away thinking that all violence and terrorism was done by Italians, and that, you know, all Italians were mafia. And so we were violent. We were the people who slapped women around, et cetera.
And Eliot Ness proved it.
That's it. And we see that. We see that thing spinning on the other side. I mean, I found that as a young man, even when I was in the monastery, you know, people who didn't have Italian backgrounds all made a presumption that I knew a lot about mafia, that I came from that background, you know. And then I watched the TV shows. You can imagine now how people deal with, you know, when they're seeing Muslims. And we're in a society where if you want reality show on Muslims, you actually have pockets in that society of anti-Muslim people who want to get rid of that one reality show because, in fact, this reality show is showing reality.
One final question, and you touched on it. For people wanting to improve the situation, you start with civil society, you seem to be saying, and that is basically one-to-one, neighbour-to-neighbour. Community groups, that is your sports clubs, your civic clubs, that's the way through. It seems to me there's a role for religion in that. That is that religious groups, Muslim, Christian, Jew, Hindu, all know that at the heart they've got questions of value, and at the heart of most is a love thy neighbour ethic. Yet it's the religious groups who can tend to pull apart. It does depend very much on the view of religion. Is religion about walls of defence, or is it about a platform for a bridge?
Yeah, I mean, one of the great ironies about religion, I mean, having spent a lot of time studying it, is, for example, just as, you know, take Jews, Christians, and Muslims, you know, all three and their believers believe that God is compassionate and merciful. And they embrace the idea, love God and love of neighbor. But as I like to put it, the dirty little secret is that too often they think God is compassionate and merciful just to them, people like themselves. And love the neighbor, the question becomes, who's the neighbor? Now, today, that's begun to be broadened by a lot of, increasingly, in recent decades, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And so, for example, on the Muslim side, you have a document called A Common Word Between Us and You, a major document which most people aren't even aware of. More than 300 major Muslim religious leaders, Muslims, signed off on it, and then the documents went to the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Pope, major religious leaders. They signed off on it. The basic of the document is to say, look, we have our differences, but we live in a world which is challenged on many levels globally in terms of violence, the environment, etc. And they went back on, you know, what do we share in common? Love of God and love of neighbor. And if people actually take a look, they'll see that they back it up with a heck of a lot of scriptures. The fact is, we need to emphasize that side. You know, we need to counter the dark side of religion. And even bigger, and I think people can meet, therefore, seeing that commonality, okay? If God's compassionate and merciful, then why is it that many people opt for what I call the Hyatt Regency approach to salvation? Hyatt Regencies have glass elevators, so the way I know I'm going up is that I have to see people going down. And so, therefore, the other people, if they walk into a big ballroom and it's crowded with a lot of people of mixed faith, or even people of their own faith, but who don't just believe exactly the way they do. So what I'm really saying is the challenge is to take pluralism seriously. And certainly I think if you read the Gospels, the Jesus of the Gospels, and not looking at what a lot of Christians have done that is actually very negative and triumphalist, there's a lot of good stuff that comes out of Christianity. And if you also read, you know, the Old Testament, and if you read the Quran, if you look at that, you ought to be able to see that underlying commonality despite the differences, and the believers ought to be able to affirm that. Now, lots of them are, but there are still people who just feel when they think of religious pluralism, it's sort of like faith should give me absolute certitude. And so if I've got absolute certitude, it's got to be that only my faith has a lock on the truth. Not that other faiths also have truths in them. I, for myself, may feel that this is the best expression. Unless we can move beyond that, I think we're really in trouble.
John Esposito, let's have a final word, and we'll make it a musical one. What would you like?
Oh, I think it's a great hymn, a humbling hymn, and one that has real historic value, Amazing Grace.
Professor John Esposito, thanks so much for giving us your time on Sunday night.
Thank you very much. It's been a joy.